Good evening, everybody. It's 8 o'clock on Wednesday night, as we do every Wednesday night here in New Jersey. It's time for New Jersey Revolution Radio Live. I am very excited this week. My name is Brian Powers, by the way, and I am very excited this week to welcome our July guest host, Lark. Hey, Lark, how you doing?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. This isn't our first time working together on something, no. But I'm pretty sure it's our first time ever doing like a joint production show together. You've been on, we've interviewed you, you've been part of panels, and you've blogged for New Jersey Revolution Radio. And if people aren't familiar with Lark, I will tell you just quickly, you know, why I'm really excited to have her be a part of the show for at least a month here on New Jersey Revolution Radio Live is because she's not just like the star of the show. She's like one of our first supporters and fans. She's donated. And when I started this, when I was just recording a thing on my cell phone on the way to work in the mornings, she was one of a few people that said, you know, you can do this, keep at it, you know, and everybody who tries stuff like this, you have moments and times where you think this is kind of dumb and nobody cares and I'm just doing this for nobody. But Lark, I want to thank you for supporting me and reminding me that people cared and do like what we do here at New Jersey Revolution Radio. And it's just an honor to be here. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you for doing this show. You know, I'm a longtime DIY person, and I love the fact when people build their own vehicles when there's not a vehicle here. I mean, editorial journalism is important in regards to informing people. So you're doing a great service, and I'm glad to be part of today. So yeah. Amazing. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Lark is originally, now you're originally from the West Coast. You've been around a lot. I know you seem to have an affinity to talk about the West Coast and West Coast culture. So there's some clashes here on New Jersey Revolution Radio Live.
The joke is, I'm from Los Angeles. I actually even have a story about that, because I do poetry and I do stories and I make a joke about myself, because I always introduce myself as, hi, my name is Lark and I'm from Los Angeles.
They have to know that about you first, right?
Yeah. That's what you have to know first, which is why because the country of Los Angeles, or what do you call it? The something of New Jersey? What do you call it? The Republic of New Jersey?
No, the Democratic People's Republic of New Jersey. It's in reference to my hopes and dreams of becoming a communist state, like a Cuba on mainland America.
You know, that dream is kind of, it's coming closer and closer to that could actually happen. You know, like, you think about it, like 2 years ago, you'd be like, that sounds like not reasonable. But now anything's possible. I think that's the great thing about having what's happening right now. I mean, we have COVID. We have, you know, we have so many things that are happening right now. You're like, wow, you know, I used to think that things weren't possible, but if all these horrible things were possible, really good things are possible too. I mean, keep it positive.
Why not a communist? Why not? So, with West and East Coast, as you know, to start off, I'm glad to be here, but we are starting off the show on a bit of a sad note, but I hope it's not too sad. I really don't. I want to welcome in our first guest, Steve Soltysik. And a lot on the left, hey, Steve, how you doing? A lot on the left might recognize that name. Steve, in his own right, is a great activist. We talked a little bit about your efforts there. But his brother, Mimi Soltysik, who's a party figure at Socialist Party USA. Lark, I know, has been a member. I have interacted with Socialist Party. I know Pat over here and through the Greens have had a lot of partnerships with Socialist Party. And I had the chance to meet Mimi a couple times. Mimi, unfortunately, passed away in this last week at only 45 years old of cancer. He'd been battling it for a little while. And Steve, thanks for being here tonight and talking about Mimi, man. How you doing?
All right. Thank you for having me. I just want to start off with by saying that if you knew Mimi, you know that this better be funny, because he wouldn't want us to be sad. He'd want us to, you know, laugh and have a good time.
I'd love to hear some stories about Mimi. I think my first one, I said on Facebook, I did a meeting with him. We do icebreakers. A lot of organizers, when you start off a meeting, do icebreakers. Usually it's like, where are you from? Where do you work? What kind of activism do you do? What's your issue? There's a trend in activism to try lighten it up a little bit. And I think one of the first ones I got was Mimi. And Mimi started off his presidential. I went to see him in Philadelphia, room of about 40 people. I met your father, was in that meeting, I believe, because you guys grew up in Pennsylvania.
Yep.
And he started off the meeting by not talking about anything political. He asked us what our first concert was. And man, like if that wasn't the fucking perfect icebreaker, man, because who has a bad memory? It doesn't matter. You were young. It was a band you loved. We probably with people that you love. Usually your parents took you with some friends. And it right away, I remember Paul McCartney. My mom and dad took me to see Paul McCartney in Giant Stadium when I was like in seventh grade. And, you know, it was just there were nosebleed seats. It was probably a terrible concert. But because, you know, I was young and it was my first concert, it was a warm memory. So it just got the meeting off to a great start. And that was the kind, like you said, he was a fun dude. Was he like that growing up? Absolutely.
So Meme and I grew up on a farm just on the outskirts of Reading, Pennsylvania. You know, and probably because being isolated on a farm like that, where you know we grew up as each other's best friends. I could give you so many stories from, you know, why I have bumps in my ears and or you know one really funny thing about Meme that. You know, it was always his go-to answer when you had to do something and he kind of really didn't know what to do, but he always wanted to show like he knew. You know, he had this story about, I remember being 4 years old and my shoelace came untied. And I went to him and said, Meme, can you tie my shoe? And he was like, well, here, this is what the pros do. And so he tied it in a knot and just twisted it and twisted and twisted it. And so that was his thing is, you know, if he didn't really know, he'd say, well, this is what the pros do. And so he'd make something up, you know. You know, I was thinking his first concert at that meeting was probably either Metallica or Motley Crue, someone like that. I don't know. I remember, you know, my first concert was Guns N' Roses and Aerosmith. And mm-hmm. when you said that my dad was there, I was actually on his shoulders that whole concert. So I remember that exact icebreaker for that. So
are you his younger brother?
I'm younger. I'm 4.5 years younger, 5 grades younger. So I did a lot of going up through high school. You're Mimi's brother.
Did you ever meet Mimi Larka in person?
Yes, I did. I actually did meet him. I met him in New York when he came. It was very bizarre because when I was in Los Angeles, I would always hear his name, but I never we never kind of like crossed paths. I think he was from a different part of Los Angeles. Los Angeles is huge, and there are lots of people. And I hadn't burned my current bridge to get to that bridge yet, to get to Mimi yet. So I met him when I came to New York, and I was just kind of like, wow, he's like really happy like all the time. And I just remember seeing him. Oh, you know what's funny? The first time I actually met Mimi, and this is like why, I used to have a newspaper in Inglewood called the Morningside Park Chronicle, and he ran for office against Simona Faris. And I remember like the spot Yvonne Burke has now, he ran for her seat. He ran for office and he went to the event. Anyway, it's an all black community. And so everyone's very conservative. And then Mimi comes in with like shorts and a t-shirt. And I was like, and it was weird because then like a few like years later, I was like, oh, that's that dude. That's Mimi. And it was weird because I'm a fourth generation Angeleno. I knew certain worlds. Like I knew Burke. But then at the same time, I knew the radical world. So it was like weird because those two worlds collided because they almost never did. So it was very bizarre. Mm-hmm. That's my little Mimi story.
Yeah. Mimi didn't code switch a lot. I think Mimi was just always Mimi. I know that, like, and I do tend to code switch a little bit myself when I tailor my pitch to the audience. And I've tried not to. I've tried to cut down on that as I grow older. Mimi doesn't seem to have that battle. He was a wear his heart on the sleeve kind of guy, right?
Yes, always.
This is always right.
Yeah, super genuine. You know, the same person that you all saw publicly is what we saw at home. Yeah. You know, I mean, we'd laugh all the time, quiz each other on movie stuff, and then you know, and then he would call me on something that I'd have to relearn on. You know, hey, that don't use that word anymore. Okay, you know, so. But I mean, everything's humor and sarcasm in our family. And I think that is number one. I think Meme's biggest gift was probably being able to connect to people on a you know, a very individual level. It's almost a superpower. You know, my girlfriend's an English teacher, and when Mimi came to the strike, she told me a story that, you know, he was eating an In-N-Out burger and just kind of like regular Mimi sloppy. And he just turns to her and goes, "So do you prefer fiction or nonfiction?" And she was like, that was such a poignant question, so specific to her interests, that he was really good at reading the room and just actively listening to what you had to say, not waiting for his turn. Yeah. So he was super good at that. And, you know, the outcry, or the, you know, what we're getting from people on Facebook and the private messages are all about, you know, their individual connections to him and how he really made them feel special.
Yeah. He did that with
me. And then talk to them about their favorite band.
Yeah, he did that. And also, I don't want to make light of the fact that he was extraordinarily serious about the cause too. I mean, yes, he was this personality, and he's kind of a bit of a larger than life. But when he talked about fighting racism, when he talked about socialism, and you know the things that he wanted to do for a socialist party, which he truly loved that party, man, and the people in it. He was as serious as they came, you know, and he was on the front lines confronting fascists with cameras, you know, and did that kind of stuff. And I remember the video of him, you know, going after Trumpers and stuff, where they were pointing at him. See, it's a commie. He's got the tattoo on his chest.
Yeah.
You know, and there was, he put himself in some serious danger, like a lot of activists do. So he was a soldier for the cause, man. I really want to thank you so much.
Yeah.
I know that Mimi had a wife. I know he has other family. Yeah. I don't know if there's tributes or donations people can make. How are you honoring him?
Right now, if you go to Mimi's Facebook page, you'll see there's a GoFundMe, and that's to help with a lot of the medical bills and closing costs and things like that. That's still open. And right now, that's the only one I know of. For sure.
Yeah. Capitalism's haunting him even now, man. And I think his comrades owe it to him to pick him up. So check that out. Leah, if you can find Mimi Salty Six's Facebook page, she's on my friends list. If you could put up that GoFundMe in comments, we appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, we got a lot more to talk about, too, this whole West Coast, East Coast thing. We'll get back into the rivalry. All right.
West Coast, the best coast.
Thanks a lot. All right. So that's Steve Saltysick, Mimi's brother. And thanks a lot, everybody. Again, check out that GoFundMe if you're friends with Mimi on Facebook. It's on there already. If not, we'll have the link up for you soon. So we want to come from the West Coast back home. Now, we just represented the West Coast with Mimi Saltysick.
Yes. You don't have a beer. What are you doing?
I gotta stroke my face because I'm watching this going, oh, this is how I'm representing my home state. Let's take a look at what's happening in Montclair, New Jersey.
Montclair.
And that reminds me of the Socialist Party. This is the city that Chris Christie said all the communists in Montclair, and we immediately thought of Greg Payson and Socialist Party, you know, the Montclair
guy. You know,
I'm just saying, Chris Christie was a liar and an asshole, but he wasn't really lying that time.
I was like, well, there are a lot of socialists there. I mean, that's not communist, but
15 now was born in a coffee shop. Another story. But let's listen to what's her name? Susan from Montclair.
We expect that of Amy's. We expect that.
Now, this is her neighbor.
We expect that.
And there's a woman walking around.
That's what you know. He did not.
With a cell phone in the middle of the street.
No.
You're his spouse. Yeah, can I please get a 44 Norman Road? I need an officer.
She needs an officer.
Wow. This is what she's doing.
So something is wrong in Montclair.
To do this. She's been waiting 2 years to do this.
She was pushed.
She's been waiting 2 years to do this.
That's why she's calling the police.
To us.
All right. Now, this is a horrible scene. Something has gone terribly wrong for this woman in life, and it needs to be corrected. And it can only be corrected by a phone call to the police, of course.
And that's her neighbor. It's amazing.
He pushed her.
Yes. And the whole thing was that he didn't push her. And a thing that I want to know is, do people named Susan go to kindergarten? Because as you know, I was an early childhood teacher. Yeah. And when people came to me and they would be tattletales, I would ask, is someone in danger? Can someone get hurt? Can I get hurt? And am I minding my business? If Susan had followed the rules that you learned in kindergarten, this wouldn't have happened. Her life wouldn't be what it is right now. I heard somebody, they did a little march on her street.
This is New Jersey. Just say, don't be a rat.
That's- don't be a rat.
You're a rat. What happened now? So this, I mean, what, you understand the story. What happened? Why was she calling the police about a guy pushing her in the first place? What?
Well, the whole backstory, this is what was relayed to me, and this is what happened. It's a African-American couple. They're both lawyers, and they live next door to Susan. Apparently, they built a patio, and Susan did not think that they had a permit. So she went into their backyard.
As any reasonable person would.
Because that's what reasonable people do. And then proceeded to, like, you know, just, oh, well, I'm going to call the police because you can't do that. And then she said that the husband pushed her, but everybody in the neighborhood, you know how, like, I'm saying, you know how New Jersey, you guys don't have, like, gates and stuff? Right. So no, everybody could see what happened. So everybody's like, no, he didn't push you. That didn't happen. And the thing is that this is just a habit of this, you know, Black people can't be in public space. We can't be in third space, that kind of space between public and private space, like Starbucks, kind of public, private. We can't social distance because we get arrested more. And now, apparently, if you are Black and you have a degree and you have a house in Montclair, you can't even be outside your house. Like, maybe it's the Skip Gates type. Remember Skip Gates, who got arrested for going into the Harvard professor who got arrested going into his own house in Massachusetts? Yeah,
there's been, I mean, Breonna Taylor was shot in her own bed. I mean, this isn't new. I mean,
No. And it's just, and that's what everybody was saying. They were like, how could you do this in this climate? And she didn't even care. She was just doubling down, like, I don't care. And the thing is that even though people were kind of like, they kind of rallied behind her and things like that, it's like, wow, you shouldn't have to deal with this. Like, if you're, you know, it's because white supremacy kind of handles and takes care of people who do that. It's kind of like, yeah, she's an individual person, but the fact that she's getting harassed, that they're getting harassed by her, and the fact that for 2 years she got away with that, because if you're Black, even if, you know, you're a professional, even if you own a home, if you even begin to argue, you're viewed as angry, and you could be viewed as a target. So this is horrific.
And on top of it all, now, I just, while you were talking a little bit, I read the article. I finally popped up the article and looked at the background on it. You don't need a permit to put stone in your backyard. They weren't even constructing. You're talking about some people putting some stonework in their backyard.
And I've seen so many people do that. I don't know. I've seen some people here during quarantine talk about them building a patio. Like, I'm building a backyard. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, the whole world right now is building their backyard.
Yeah. So I don't understand what that. Well, I do. It was racism. That's what that was. I don't understand exactly what it was. But
yeah,
I'm just trying to think about the reasoning. I mean, it's just so childish and just so ridiculous. And why wouldn't you just go back in your house? Just go back in your house.
And I think the way, you know, and the way everybody in this situation and in so many situations is reversed. And you talked a little bit about New Jersey and our culture of lying here. And just
oh, my God. How do you just lie here? No offense. Not, I'm sure not everybody, well, hashtag not all of New Jersey. But not all of New Jersey. But I've seen this outright lying. But I mean, this is something that happens with the police do. You know, this is national. Oh, I was afraid. I'm scared. I had to like shoot him. Oh, she's 4 years old. I was afraid. I had to put handcuffs on her. Oh, I'm like, it's a continuous lie. Like, we know you can get away with it.
Yeah, it's and I said, when you said the police, I associated with the police, and then I started associating it because the cops are so involved with our political culture. And you know, I spent time in Trent, and when I went to Trent, as a slightly left of center kind of, like, not even slightly left of center, slightly left of radical kind of, but they're very skeptical. I went there like, you know, but I started thinking, like, as I geared up to start the job, I was like, I'm gonna meet the good people. There's got to be good people in Trent. I'm gonna meet.
Yeah.
the few good people. I'm going to rile them up. We're going to work together. I'm going to, you know, over the years, I'm going to get my crew together and we're going to do good things because there's got to be some good people in Trent. There aren't. There's not one decent. I didn't find anybody there at any level except for like staffers and the people that, you know, do the real work.
Well, I think that's one of the challenges about New Jersey is that even on the Democratic Party, you have such kind of corrupt, shady people. And then you end up, and what happens is like, okay, and this is not, my mom's like totally radical, but she understood how Christie happened. Christie happened because of how shady the Democrats were. So they're like, well, it can't get worse than this. Because the thing is that we've already been taught like, you know, this binary system. Well, it's got to be this party or this party. And the thing is that this place is ripe for, hey, third party, ripe for the Green Party, the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, hey, anything, because they got to be better than this.
you would think, but it's not even that well organized. The thing is, it's a culture thing. It's a culture thing. It's a thing that in Trenton, in New Jersey politics, in dealing with the police, you can do or say whatever you want as long as you get ahead. And in Trenton, it's about grabbing the brass ring. Nobody's ever going to speak up against these political bosses, whether it be a union boss or a nonprofit head or, you know, an assemblyman or an assemblywoman. It doesn't matter because as long as you get on top of that pile in that fight, you continue your career. You keep getting your contracts for your buddies. You got your little empire going and you can continue it. There really is no, there's never a discussion about what's best for the state. There's just
I think because you guys are simply like, and how do I say this in a nice way? You know, it seems like New Jersey exists to be for New York. It's like everything's about New York. And even when I've had challenges. If I've had challenges with people in New Jersey, I'll write something in a New York publication and it would actually be quicker than me going to a meeting in New Jersey.
The biggest challenge we have is that we are between two of the largest. New York is the number one media market in the country. I think Philly's like the fourth.
Yeah.
So to try to get intention in between those two gigantic entities, we're constantly left with this, you know, kind of middle child syndrome.
When I see the New York press coming to New Jersey, I know something's up. I'm like, why is the Wall Street Journal here? What's going on? Anytime somebody on the left gets interviewed by the Wall Street Journal, I'm like, hey, what's? I'm not going to get into that subject right now, though.
No, it's okay because we can start our commercial segment now.
Okay.
And actually, nobody bought a commercial this week, so I give away a free commercial. And they are, you know, they're very lucky that I love them. Here's our commercial music. Have you heard our commercial music?
Yeah, I have.
This is fun. I got two people. My business partner hates this.
It's a ska.
I found it on our free music service. We get our music licensed through service. We got through that. So our sponsor tonight is going to be the Green Party of New Jersey. The Green Party of New Jersey is cool. And they asked me to make sure that people get out there and sign petitions for their candidates. So they didn't pay for this spot. And I got to say that because they're a political party. This is just free advertising for them. Because I love them. And they want people to go outside. So you got to sign the petition. So if you go to gpnj.org, or you can go to Madeline Hoffman's website, Hoffman for Senate.com, or you can go to www.howiehawkins.us, get in touch with Diane Moxley or Madeline through Facebook. They have electronic signatures. You can sign just through an Adobe thing. You type it in, that's the way I did it. And we really appreciate that. You need 800 signatures to get in New Jersey. But we can't be out at events. We can't be doing the train stations. We can't be at a 4th of July picnic coming up. So we need people to do it electronically. So check it out. Visit the websites or check them out on Facebook, Green Party of New Jersey, so you can sign candidate petitions. And now I expect a lot of donations, comrades. A lot of donations. The other plug, of course, is www.njrevolutionradio.com. Give us some money so we can continue productions. We have Lark here. She's not getting paid. She's fixing everything for us, but she's not getting paid. So we appreciate the donations. Our staff does get paid. Not enough, though. So they deserve a raise. Plus, we have to pay our standing bills and all that type of stuff. So please make sure you get paid. We're going to be welcoming Melissa here in just 1 minute. I'm a little early, but we can preface Melissa a little bit by talking about what's coming up. Because, Lark, you yourself, you touched on it a little earlier. You are an early childhood educator. And so what's your background exactly? Have you taught before or have you been?
I have taught. I'm insulted that you would even ask that question. You think I'm not a real teacher? I'm just one of those insulted people.
Being an educator.
I'm an educator. I have a California credential. I began my career as a special education preschool teacher.
Nice.
My background is I want to be like Anne Sullivan. My sister is autistic. She's my twin sister, and I've always been very supportive of her. And I've always wanted to give people what I want to help people, like I supported my sister, but in the little younger grades. So I began my career as a special education preschool teacher. And I've also taught English in alternative schools, so during the summertime. But my love and my focus has been early childhood. I was very surprised when I met my sisters and brothers in early childhood and realized, because I was a credentialed teacher through the feds and the traditional K-12, even though I was preschool, how little my early childhood other people in the field got paid. I was like, how do you live? And so that's one of my other causes, is to get people to pay early childhood professionals a living wage, because they're not union, they're the lowest paid. And it's not like you could just step in there. You have to have education. You have to have a background check. You're working with people who we care about, our little children. And so, it's really disturbing to me what's happened in regards to COVID. People keep saying, we need to open up regards to the early childhood centers. But I'm like, are we paying them extra money? We're trying to get it's like there's a thing called, it's almost like, I feel like early childhood workers are sacrificial workers, not essential workers. I'm like, this is outrageous. You're not paying them more money. They're already anyway, I could go on and on. Are we with the next segment now? Or
No, I mean, my expertise has come from raising five children. And, I have five boys. It started at ages 20 and run down to the age of five. And
kids are so good. He's such nice boys. It's amazing. I mean, not like amazing, but I'm just saying, you could tell how a person is when you look at their kids. So in regards to what you think about Brian, you see his kid, he's an awesome dude.
They're wonderful kids. And they're pretty well behaved. I mean, I see them through a father's eyes, but I think they're pretty well behaved kids, right?
They're good. Your kids are really good.
I can't keep the five of them to social distance at home. I don't know how the hell you expect any of this to go on in a school, under these COVID. So I'm looking there's Melissa now. So we'll bring in a badass teacher, Melissa Tomlinson, who's great enough to join us. Hi, Melissa. How you doing? She's muted right now.
She's muted right now.
She is.
Sorry. Hi.
That's okay. Hello. Hello. We are so happy that you're here, Melissa. And I am, I have to say that you guys are in such a hard spot here in New Jersey. I read this. I want to read a few things from a crowdsourced document that I got regarding teachers' concerns. And this is heartbreaking. If a teacher dies from COVID contracted while at school, does the state pay their surviving staff spouse the MBOS life insurance payout? These are concerns from teachers. Who will be held accountable if a second wave of COVID is caused by reopening the schools? Since masks protect others from mask wearers, it's the state's position that teachers and staff do not need to be protected, but the students need to be protected from us. How will educators be supported financially if they become permanently disabled by the virus contracted possibly at schools? Will the state attendance laws be changed so students and families aren't compelled to come to school sick? This is heartbreaking. Where does the union stand on this? And just bats in general.
Well, the union, before the state put out its guidelines, the union put out their own set of recommendations about what they would like to see in terms of, reopening schools, what the main considerations are. Definitely social distancing, masks,
But after that, it hasn't been as strong as we would like. And that's part of the reason why this document was created, because there's a lot of questions out there. I mean, basically they're saying, you know, oh, we trust that districts will put more guidelines in place if it's needed, and that, you know, we know we have to be prepared to respond quickly to changing circumstances, and that, you know, the governor's watching the data. But basically, teachers want to hear somebody say and make that decision that says, if we're not safe and if we don't have the answers that we need, we're not going back.
That's like, to me, so important, because I hear so many teachers, like, who people have told me, like, in regards to people who work in charter schools, I am scared. I need for people to speak out because I can't. I mean, and why? And also the thing too is, I noticed a lot of people are kind of couching it in, you know, we're only concerned about the children, but it's like, don't the teachers matter? I mean, the thing is that, you know, in regards to sexism and the teaching field and us being martyrs, us being sacrificial workers. I mean, the thing is that I know that men who are on Wall Street who work in the city, they're not going back in the fall. They've already been like, nope, we're going to do remote. So, I mean, and also too, in the American Academy of Pediatrics stated that social distancing for the littlest kids for early childhood isn't a priority. I mean, that's like ammo for the state. I mean, I had to look up and see who are the people on this thing. You know, how does the union go about protecting universal pre-K, because it's kind of just rolled out, first graders, kindergartners, now that they have that from the American, because that's the first thing I knew when I saw that. I was like, that's the first thing, you know, these little moles are doing. Well, American Pediatrics said we don't have to social distance. I mean, was the, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the American Pediatrics, you have to look. The children are their main concern, right? Mm-hmm. And it is safer for young children to be closer, right? We know that they don't carry the virus, that the transmission isn't as great. They're not concerned with the teachers. They don't have to answer to teachers, they have to answer to the children themselves. But you know, that kind of speaks to everything about reopening the economy. Who's being put at risk in order to make the profit, right? We want to reopen the economy. We know we have to do that by giving the workers care for the children. And so schools have typically and historically been that support. But, you know, what about the nations that have childcare within their work spaces, right? It goes to communities, right? We know that we've been able to broaden our community circles, right? I can go to my friends, the same friends that I've been in. We've been, you know, hanging out a little bit here and there. So the circle communities have broadened. Well, if you broaden a work community and you bring the families into that space, you're keeping your contact circle still limited. But once you open schools and watch the exponential contact points with different individuals and the crossing of what can potentially be transmitted, you're just opening the door again for another recurrence of the virus in this state.
It's not, to me, it's not so much about even just what's going on in schools and the teachers and these obvious immediate safety concerns, but it's about messaging and how we're behaving when we hear things. I think, in all quite honesty, first off, the science on this is not in. We don't know how this virus behaves, and any decent expert I've ever talked to is like, this is our best guess because we're trying to fix this thing as quickly as possible. You know, but science and research on a vaccine and viruses takes years by any standard of the imagination. But let's just say, like, everything we're putting out is right, that the governor's guidelines are what we should be doing. And if we do these things, we will prevent infections. That's not what people do. Just because he says wear a mask and stay 6 feet away, you think 9-10-year-old children are going to, has anybody ever met a 9-10-year-old child? And my theory is that Governor Murphy and the bourgeoisie who run in Trenton did not raise their children, that immigrant families were doing that for them. So they have no fucking idea how kids actually behave.
How many times
do I have to tell my kids to stop touching each other every day? Are you serious, Phil? Dear Leader Murphy, they're not going to stay anywhere away from each other in a classroom unless you chain them to a post in the middle of the classroom.
I think the thing, the point that Melissa brought up that was excellent was the point of contact. The thing is that, okay, maybe if the, even if the children aren't going to possibly have it or transmit it, every time people go out to pick up kids, to pick people up, to go to lunch, to do this, to do that, you risk, you end up, you know, making the risk higher. Have you guys, has the union brought that to the governor? I mean, is there anything that you guys can do in regards to that point? Or do you have your own science experts that you can, I don't know.
Yeah, so I know the union sat on the committee with the governor. They were part of this whole drafting of the plan, and they had their input.
I'm sorry, I wanted to just drop in. When you say the union, are we talking about NGAA, or who's at the bargaining table? Which union is at the table for you guys?
So I'm talking right now about NJEA. New Jersey Education Association. And I think that thought about contact is part of what led to the idea of contact tracing. So now on top of everything else that schools are responsible for, they want to have a person have to be responsible for collecting data on contact tracing in the school, right? So if somebody gets sick, then they have to start calling families. And, you know, don't you like that idea? We have enough to do. Like, we all know that educators and every single person that works in a school building has been stressed and stretched to the max as it is right now. We're facing austerity budgets, cutting of school employee positions, layoffs, reductions in staff, okay? Then you're going to add all the necessary temperature checks or whatever type of, you know, inboarding procedures are going on a daily basis to the school building. Then you want to add somebody responsible for contact tracing. And then that opened up like a whole field of questions. Well, what if a family refuses to participate in contact tracing? Who's going to follow up with that? And, you know, it's not a school's purview to begin with. It's putting the school in a very awkward and potentially illegal position. That's a whole other set of personal data. And quite honestly, I don't want that personal data known. It's not my business.
Well, even for me, I'm thinking if I were a teacher, I wouldn't want the school to have my, like, you know, they're saying, oh, if you're a teacher, you have to get checked. I'm like, well, I wouldn't want the school to have any health information on me. I would feel like that's an invasion of my privacy. Yeah. And I mean, I would want to have everybody get checked, but I don't want it to be something that the school is taking part of, like they're doing the testing. I'm just, you know, and another thing too, I read about Murphy's plan, like he's requiring in-persons. Why is it required that it's an in-person school? I mean, shouldn't that be a case by case? I mean, to me, I look at the CDC recommendations. They seemed really unreasonable. Like, there's no way. I feel like it's their way of saying we can't open up. But, you know, it's kind of like your mom tells you, hey, yeah, you can go to the park if you wash the car, clean up under the refrigerator, clean the stove, walk the dog, do your homework, call grandma. It's like, that's their way of saying no. And essentially that CDC list looks like mom telling you no, but not wanting to tell you no. And it's like, are we still playing this game? And what do you guys think about that?
That's exactly true. When the CDC guidelines came out, you know, we looked at them and that's exactly what it was. It was basically saying, okay, if you want to open schools, all of these things need to be done. And if they are not done, schools should not be open. So it was saying basically don't open schools until we are completely safe. And that the set of demands right there that Brian is showing, Group National Educators United that I'm involved in, researched the CDC demands and some other scientific data and some of the experience based upon what we did know at the time, and developed what we said would be a platform of demands for what needs to be in place for reopening. And you'll notice the number one thing right there, controlled community transmission, at least 24 days of zero reported new local community cases, right? So we recognize that things are going to look different from community to community, but then that right there opens up a whole other conversation about equity between communities and what that means for if my white suburban district can open up because we live further apart. We have access to healthcare. We have the means to be able to afford to have our groceries delivered and we can reduce our contact points versus a denser urban community that's typically Black or Brown residents who do not have that safety that we have in our community. That transmits down to, okay, well, my school's open, but your school's not. So my schools are going to have more consistent education than these students over here.
Well, I mean, another, go ahead.
Yeah, well, what I see, what I kind of see, because there has been some effort to coordinate regionally, right? I know that Murphy and New York governor, I'm sorry, is it
Cuomo.
they play golf and they decide, you know, these policies. What I see kind of is like they start off in a good direction. I actually think they started off with like some good nature. Like, listen, we need to prioritize health and we need to shut down the state and start isolating. But then the economic pressure started coming. And when I saw him get this commission together, I didn't see any doctors at any place of importance. It was all business leaders. And what I'm seeing is like, oh, let's open up the schools because of either economic or social pressures. And then the pushback of, no, that's fucking stupid because there's a virus that's going to kill people. And so it's I'm not seeing consistency from Governor Murphy. As much as I think he's gotten praise and a lot of people say he's one of the more responsible governors, that may be true, but the most responsible out of a whole bunch of irresponsible capitalists is still not responsible. And it's clear to me that this is being driven by money, by economic interest. If it was driven by science and medical clarity, we would have doctors all over these policies. And you've got a scant few that are probably sitting in the corner of the room being told to shut up. Because I've seen that it's just tokenizing a doctor as all as I'm concerned. If you've got a policy committee and you've got five corporate pigs, six people from the Chamber of Commerce, a bunch of assemblymen, lawyers, attorneys, and then there's a doctor, who gives a hell? Who cares what that doctor has to say? And I don't know, you know, how close you've been to the discussions, Melissa, but how much of this is a health issue and how much of it is just we want to get back to normal despite the evidence being we should be home, not being normal?
Yeah, you just have to look at Atlantic City to know that this is an economic decision, right? We're ready to open the casinos.
Oh, yeah, because we need to gamble. That's essential.
Atlantic City's economy is based on that. And Atlantic City is so far in the hole as far as foreclosures and services for people in the community, not only in the city, but in the county. So the answer to that, okay, well, we'll open up the casinos. We'll create this indoor space where people can come and there we go. You know, it's a total monetary economy based decision. And unfortunately, most of the decisions are based like that. Decisions have been based like that in schools for years. That's what led us to Common Core. That's what led us to high-stakes standardized testing. That's what's driving a lot of the reforms that we're seeing. And it's time that we reprioritize our ideals in this state from leadership on down.
Well, I mean, even to go back to your equity question, you know, you have teachers that are in areas that are more economically and education regards to they have less resources and they might be at higher risk physically and mentally owing to the impact of COVID. We look at places like the Bronx. We look at places like the eastern part of Brooklyn and how many people died. How is the union going to take care of, because the thing is that it's like when they open up, you know, in an ideal world, it seems like, oh, okay, the suburbia would open up sooner. But I see pressure, which is bizarre, from kind of like, oh, we have to open up the poorer areas, the more economically oppressed areas first because they need to work. And I'm like, don't they need stipends? They're like, oh, well, they're going to lose school out on school. So, you know, death is more, you know, death is not as much of a priority as schooling. I mean, have you seen that weird conversation? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, it has been really weird. And it's this fear of not being able to still give the students what they need, right? And instead of reimagining how we could deliver services, we're trying to fit what we did in this new frame, but within the same structure still. I don't know if that's making sense, right?
Let's do that, because I've heard a ton. Look, we see the protests out in the streets for Black Lives Matter. And amidst all that protest and racism and horrible side of it, there are a lot of voices saying, let's do this better. Let's rebuild. Let's take a chance to it's all gotten torn down. I've said it, I think, on the air that, you know, radicals like to say, we need to build a new world from the ashes of the old. And we're standing in a pile of ashes. Our country is in shambles, you know. So let's do that. Let me ask my childhood educator comrades, like, what do you want? What would you want to build out of this, Melissa? What could come out of this that we're missing?
Definitely outdoor schools. That is one of the biggest ideas that is old, right? But people are talking about it again. Give me a cohort of students. Let me go meet in the neighborhood park in my school district with those students and teach them there, right? We would keep our contact down. It would just be us discussing the same group over and over again. Now, granted, at the moment, I'm certified in math and language arts, but I could do it. I'm a teacher. We know that we can take these materials and adapt them in any way that we need to do. And another thing is this idea of behind, right? We're hearing all these conversations, oh, the students miss learning, they're behind. And my question is, they're behind what? They're
exactly behind this
arbitrary set of standards that are developed by grade level that don't even follow child development anymore because they're so far out of whack with development, right? And then they're behind. Well, what about their overall human growth? Where they're behind the most right now is knowing how to respond and to handle the trauma of this virus, and especially for our Black students, of everything that they've been seeing with the Black Lives Matter movement. You yeah. watch the news and you watch a protest and you see them degrading the Black lives when the police come in with the riot gear, that has an emotional effect on our children. And they need to be given the tools and have conversations to deal with any of this before they can go and learn what 2x plus 3 equals 6 is.
And that's, you know, I mean, that is one of the things. I mean, you know, think about standardized testing, all the things that they're saying in regards to why, you know, we should have in-person learning and risk people's lives are all things that, you know, are part of the prison to pipe, you know, the school to pipeline, prison to pipeline. These are the tools that they use. They use standardized testing. They use the achievement gap. They use all of these things. These are things that should just be gone, because we see now you don't really need to have, you know, a parent's child taken away from them because they didn't show up. You really don't need to have testing, because you can get into, you know, you can get into Princeton and Harvard without an SAT or ACT now. So it shows that all the stuff they said they couldn't do was impossible. We need to have standards. You clearly can do all of these things. So, you know, let's reimagine. I mean, let's reimagine schools, reimagine housing, let's reimagine labor. I loved your idea about the teaching in the park.
That's beautiful.
But then I think about the redlining and how New Jersey is set up in regards to segregation. I'm just like, geez, like how, you know, like, you know, depending on who you are, that's really cool. Some people, that would be a great thing. Some people might teach far away, because I'm pretty sure that a lot of the African-American teachers, a lot of the Latinx teachers, at least I'm going by an LA perspective, would probably be driving a lot farther away to go to work. Go ahead.
So on that, but no, you brought up an actually a really good point. So why can't we go into the communities and say, okay, I live in this town. What other educators live in this town? Let's create a cohort of those educators and go back to the idea of freedom schools, right? We're responsible for keeping our own community. Right. Yeah. These are the children that live near me. And then you're reducing, you know, transmission even less and the amount of cross contact even less. And let's go back to that idea of teach-ins and open freedom schools and doing education the way it should be based upon the needs of that particular group of students that are in front of you at that moment of time.
Being home with my kids, and I think for all, like a lot of us who had our children unceremoniously dumped on us, you know, do this. I mean, like, first, it was a shock to the system. But, you know, you start to get into a new flow and, you know, you appreciate a little more time with your kids. So there's definitely good and bad things to it. And it also depends very much on your family situation, how much money you have, where you live and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you know, I really, the freedom school thing, though, I want to ask, what's a freedom school?
Freedom school was a movement that was started back when the Black educators and the Black students were first started being pushed out of the school system, right? There was a big push to supposedly desegregate the schools, and as a result, Black educators were pushed out because they were no longer allowed to have schools that were Black, basically, right? We have to desegregate, so then that means we have to, the way they did it was they pushed the Black students into white schools. So they completely disbanded all the Black students. And in some areas, the freedom schools were set up to continue what was going on in terms of educating around Black history, Black culture, because it was being whitewashed and continues to be whitewashed in our school system. Then, so a lot of it came out as part of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Mississippi Freedom Summer Project in 1954. I have to say, the date I was a little bit shady on, so I had to like look that date up. Just so you know, it wasn't just in my head. But I mean, it's, you know, I really feel that that's an important, we really, really need to go back to our local schools, go back to local control. And the thing is that, you know, the civil rights movement took a lot of the power away from communities because they're like, oh, since white people cannot control the Black community, we're going to take all the money away. And so they're not going to be able to control the money. They're not going to be able to control their schools. So that was kind of like the little extra kiss for the civil rights after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. So we should reimagine and, you know, and I want to ask you one little question before we go, because I know we're running out of time.
You still have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Yeah, you do. Okay.
I need to hear some music, but that's all right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I am really kind of like, you know, I really want to organize. I really want the early childhood, educators to be organized. Do you think that this might be a really good time to do the NJEA, do a real push on early childhood, the field, and make it kind of like the way the trade unions are? Like, if you are in education, if you are licensed in an early childhood education, you need to be paid this amount regardless, home, whatever, or something needs to happen. We can't have people taking care of children making the least amount of money, making less than, no one should make nothing. I hate to use people example. They should make more than people who watch cards. I hate that kind of like thing, but they are very, very low paid. They cannot survive. And now they're being forced to go out and be sacrificial workers. Do you think this would be a good time to organize them?
It would be a good time. I don't necessarily know that NJEA would be the entity that would be able to do that, because we have so many childcare providers that are not public, right? We are public school employees. And because of that, universal pre-K has not happened in our state, and we haven't pulled all the childcare workers into a public entity space. But there's definitely room for organizing there, even if it is done in an unofficial capacity, right? So if somebody who's involved in early childhood education starts to have community group grassroots calls and say, hey, let's have some conversations about what's going on. And let's make sure that we're creating spaces that are going to be safe for the children and safe for the workers. And on top of that, the one main thing that is my push when it comes to early childhood education is making sure that we are always centering play as part of the education. So much playtime has been pushed out.
It is true, but another thing we have to think about is how early childhood is racialized. And the reason why it's probably not part of NJEAA is because it's Black women and Latinx women, and this is why it's totally okay to keep them out of the union. And while I understand it's different and it's private, but if trade unions can be unionized, maybe that model might work for early childhood and you guys can bring them in just because it's...
yeah. So legally, I know we can't because there was another group that I wanted to organize as well that are working in schools, but because they're not public employees, NJEA cannot represent them. But that, again, that does not mean that another union could definitely pick that up. And I don't know offhand if there are and have been efforts to do such.
It also doesn't mean they can't form independent unions that aren't attached to all those people. I just leave it at that. That's a whole nother show is about organizing and worker, but more power to the workers if they want to organize. We do got to wrap it up. I got time to plug stuff though. So Melissa, quickly to plug organizations and things. I know you want money somewhere, so please.
Okay, so Badass Teachers Association is one of them. And then another one that I'm involved in is National Educators United. So those are the two main vehicles that I operate through. New Jersey is going to be having some statewide conversations. In fact, Lark, you might want to join in if you get a chance, but we're having community members and educators in the same space and talking about what we need to come together on before schools are opened.
Awesome. All right. Thanks a lot. I didn't get to it, but Melissa is an all-around activist. I've been working with Melissa for years. She's part of the original 15 Now crew, and she's just amazing. So follow her wherever you see her. Make sure that you pay heed because she's an important voice in New Jersey. Lark, did you have fun on your first show?
I had a lot of fun, and I appreciated being here, and I learned a lot from Melissa and Steven and you, and I'm just excited to come here next week. Excited to be on next week.
Leah is there. Leah's writing away. Hi, Leah. Did you enjoy this one? It felt like a long time in between shows. I don't know. Was this one a long time or?
No, I loved it. I think it's a little bit longer than any of the shows I've been here for so far.
I appreciate all the hard work. And again, please donate to New Jersey Revolution Radio, www.njrevolutionradio.com. The Green Party owes me money for a free plug today. So if you're green, make a donation, definitely. But everybody else, please help support our streamers, our staff, pay the overhead. We don't make a ton of money here. It's a small budget, so every little dollar counts. I am going to leave you with a song by my comrades at Gumbo La Funk. You may know Andrea Meridia Cuellar. She's been on New Jersey Revolution Radio before. She is the campaign manager for the Howie Hawkins campaign, so she's kind of my boss, full disclosure. But she is also a backup singer for this band. And the song I'm going to play is called She Taught Us. Can anyone on the panel, before we go, guess who we are talking about when we say she taught us? You get one guess. Lark, go.
Betty Davis.
This song is a tribute to our comrade who lives safely in Cuba, as she will for the rest of her life under the protection of that state. Our comrade's name is Assata Shakur. This is She Taught Us by
Gumbo. My second guest.
We will see you next week on New Jersey Revolution Radio, www.njrevolutionradio.com, NJRR Live. Thanks again, everybody, for being here. See you next week.
your pride. Don't need what I ain't got, and I won't take it from you. But I'm gonna get what they got, then I'm gonna give it to you. Every day, in every way, it is our duty to fight for freedom. Do not let them take your pride. It is our duty to fight and bend. There's no place you can hide. It is our duty to love. Nothing to lose but our chance. When is enough enough? When is too much too much? What can a dollar buy? How can a dollar buy? Celebrate your freedom.
Love each other. You may think it's an impossibility.